from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In the writings of social critics such as Matthew Arnold in Victorian England, Dwight MacDonald in America in the 1930s and 40s, and Leslie Fiedler in the 1980s, questions arise as to the value of popular culture. For example, are movies, television, and soap operas throwaway junk? Can they yield important insights about the nature and direction of American society? Those questions are central to the scholarship of two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Colin McCabe of the University of Pittsburgh and Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina. This week on Soundings, a conversation with Colin McCabe about literature, film, and popular culture. Next week on Soundings, a discussion with Robert Allen about his new book on soap operas. Colin McCabe is a professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh and a member of the production board of the British Film Institute. In addition to articles and reviews, Colin McCabe is the author of two books about literature, film, and popular culture, and of a collection of essays on film, linguistics, and literature. Colin McCabe, you teach literature at the University of Pittsburgh. You're also interested in film. Why should a serious scholar of literature look at the movies? Isn't this a popular form that really doesn't deserve the attention of literary types?
Well, I think there's several levels of answer to that. Let's take a kind of simple way. If you're studying 20th century literature, there's no way, I think, that you can seriously study 20th century literature without considering film. Take Joyce, for example, which is one of my favorite authors. Joyce opened the first cinema in Dublin. Eisenstein read a lot of Joyce, went and saw Joyce in Paris. You can't really understand a lot of what Joyce is doing in his writing unless you actually understand something about the history of cinema and something crucially about the way in which the moving image alters the relation to the written speech, written forms of the language, and the relation between speech and writing. Now, there's a kind of, as I say, I want to start on a simple level, just anecdotal. Joyce opening cinemas, Faulkner writing in Hollywood. There's hardly a major American writer in the 20th century you can think of who hasn't spent some time screenwriting. Now, on one hand, people will say, oh, well, they just do it for the money. On the other hand, I think there's a very interesting way of understanding the relation between those experiences of screenwriting and their own work. So there's a kind of a simple scholarly answer, which is if you're studying the 20th century and you ignore film, then you're actually ignoring a crucial literary history.
Well, my experience is that there are no such things as simple scholarly answers. Let's take it from that angle. Why don't the scholars themselves pay attention to film? I see your point about historical Joyce opening cinema, that sort of thing.
Okay, so we go on to this. There's a second point. I mean, I'm gonna move on. The second point why they ought to do this is because that's what their students look at. Particularly, and here I think you can't just talk about film. You've also got to talk about television. That the simple fact of the matter is that kids who come up at 18 or 19 to university now, their major cultural and aesthetic experiences come through television or through rock music.
How many thousands of hours have they sat in front of them?
If you pretend that their major cultural experience is literature, you are starting out with a lie, and you're starting out with a lie which you will simply compound as you teach.
Well, now, let me get you to pause on this, Colin. Our topic is film and literature. Why have the professionals, why have your colleagues in the academy resisted the use of film?
I think we come to the third level, we come to the real crucial level, which is that the place that literature occupies in our culture and the kind of importance and value that's given to it really does go back all the way to the Renaissance, to the invention of printing, and a certain valorization of written forms, the way in which throughout Europe in the 16th century, as national identities were fostered, as people began to write in their own tongues, the whole effort was to say, if you're a proper nation, one of the things you need is a proper literature. I mean, it's very clear if you read Sidney's Apology for Poetry, for example, that he thinks for England to become a proper nation, it actually has to write a literature that will rival Greece and Rome. Simply what happens, I mean, very simply what happens, is that you get the you get a spread of education, the formation of what we can recognizably see as modern educational curriculum, based on Greek and Latin, based on literature, and associated with that, the production of national literatures. And those national literatures which are produced are marked by their relation to Greek and Latin, and also marked by the way in which they exclude various popular forms of culture. Uh-huh. I mean, if you take the Elizabethan theatre is a kind of an amazing moment, because you actually get the union of popular forms and of Renaissance humanism.
Right, that's all Shakespeare was popular culture.
Popular culture. That wasn't all he was. I mean, what's interesting about Shakespeare is he's popular culture. I mean, it's juggling, it's dancing. I mean, the notion that, I mean, the Elizabethan theatre, if you think of it as a mix between the Super Bowl and the rock concert, that's better than thinking about the kind of darkened auditorium which you go in at night and kind of like watch a kind of something up on the stage. That wasn't what the Elizabethan theatre was like at all. But it wasn't just popular, it was also informed by exactly the classical heritage which had been uncovered since Petrarch, 200 years of that. So it isn't just popular forms. What's interesting then is that those popular forms get systematically written out, systematically excluded. It's very obvious in French history in the 17th century, but it happens the same in English history in the 17th century.
Who did this, Colin? Was it the professors? Was it an accident?
No, it certainly wasn't an accident. It was a kind of, it was basically a, I mean, in my opinion, what it was a new class which wanted to appropriate for itself various cultural forms. It wanted to appropriate forms on the one hand from, as it were, popular forms, which they associated. I mean, the Puritans, for example, associated the theatre quite straightforwardly with the brothels. They associated with various kinds of carnivalesque festival, which they saw as a waste of money.
There was a lasciviousness to it all.
They saw it as two things. They saw it as too much sex and too much money.
Yeah.
They wanted to save the money and save the sex. and basically they're the people who effectively form a new culture. Now, it's never as simple as that, because for the next 300 or 400 years, what you get is constant attempts for these popular forms to get back in. And I mean, the most important, in my opinion, is Romanticism, when you actually get a very serious attempt to alter the relation of the literary language to what is felt to be a language closer. I mean, in Wordsworth's famous phrase of men speaking to men.
Yeah.
But I would argue that nevertheless, despite this constant battle, there is still a sense in which, until the end of the 19th century, that culture formed at the Renaissance, that culture formed as a class culture, formed for this new class, determined, as I say, to wrest culture on the one hand from the people, but on the other hand from the monarchy. And that's very important. I mean, the Puritans are not just anti these popular forms in the theatre, they're also anti the court forms of entertainment.
All right, now, Colin, you're telling me that we have a very lopsided inheritance, as it were, the mixture between popular culture and what might be called highbrow art and writing, poetry, that sort of thing. Were there people along the way? You began our conversation by referring to the Renaissance. You've been talking about Elizabethan theater. Were there critics along the way who said, "Wait a minute, we're being unfair to what today we would call popular culture"? You've mentioned Wordsworth. Yeah. I don't really think of him as a pop culture type, although he did say that poets should use the language of ordinary people.
Yeah. I don't think there's I don't know of any substantial attack on that tradition, because it's actually based on certain forms of education and certain forms of technology. And what happens at the end of the 19th century, and this is, as I say, where it comes to an end, is two things happen. First of all, everybody gets taught to read, basically, in Western Europe. And it's very important, particularly if you're thinking of the professors of literature who don't want, as it were, to consider film, and who kind of moan, as I mean, they've been moaning for 50 years about the decline of an educated audience, etc. The decline of an educated audience, which is dated at the end of the 19th century, is actually the exact date when you get an educated audience. That's to say, when the whole people get educated.
It's just the reverse.
It's just the reverse. Uh-huh. But of course, what happens when the whole people get educated is, at the same time, because the reason you get them educated is because we've got new forms of capital technology, and those new forms of capital technology themselves start producing new forms of writing. Most importantly, the mass circulation newspapers in the 1890s. At that point, you really get the beginning of this crisis in the culture, of which I would only see film as one part,
right,
whereby the writer can no longer think that he's writing, and I mean, it's always a him up till then, even if it is a woman,
right,
in some sense, in that sense, writing for the audience, because the audience has proliferated. Mm-hmm. There's just too much, there's too many of them. They're all reading, and they're not reading mm-hmm. within this defined tradition.
All right, Colin McCabe, you've put a lot of issues on the table here. Our topic is the relationship between film and literature, high and low culture. Are you telling me that things like Dynasty and Dallas and rock groups that go around the country or around the world, that they have a sort of cultural value that's equivalent to... Well, what is it equivalent to?
No, I don't think they have a cultural value that's equivalent to. I think that what one has got, what we've now got to do, and what the problem that's facing us, is that the criteria of value, which have mm-hmm. worked, have been put in place for 300 or 400 years, are increasingly becoming difficult, more and more difficult to sustain. Now, what happens then, and I can take an example from film with Cahiers du Cinéma. Let's just take film. Standardly, what happens is that you get a popular form like film, and you get a group of intellectuals who want to say, now, actually, these films are really... Hollywood isn't just a kind of load of old rubbish. If you actually look at kind of Ford, if you look at Hawks, if you start looking mm-hmm. at these films,
you will see some art.
Now, but this is the point. Their move is actually a very traditional one. What they say is, they don't say, let's rethink high and low culture. What they say is, these bits of low culture are really high culture. And that's effectively what Cahiers du Cinéma did in the 50s. I mean, probably the most effective cultural intervention that I know of. Mm-hmm. That's to say, they went to the Hollywood tradition, they reread it selectively, and they mm-hmm. produced all these authors.
Let's just say parenthetically, you were talking about an intellectual journal published in France.
Yes, I'm talking about a journal set up by the French critic André Bazin, mm-hmm. which immediately got a group of young critics, Truffaut, Godard, Rivette, who through the early part of the 50s wrote these extremely influential rereadings of Hollywood history, and then in the later part of the 50s went on to make the French New Wave. They went on to, mm-hmm. they're the first wave of directors who went first of all from writing about cinema mm-hmm. and then to making it. But what is important in the context of this discussion is that they valued cinema by using the traditional terms of high culture and going to a bit of popular culture and saying, this isn't really... This is popular culture, but actually it's just as good as high culture. Mm-hmm. I want to make a more radical point, which is that we've somehow got to think of different ways of evaluating the culture itself, that's it, or the cultures, these forms. It's not a question of going, say, to the Beatles, which would be another example, and saying, these are great poets, or going to Bob Dylan, as some particularly stupid literary critics do, and saying, you know, here is a great poet in the Anglo-American tradition. He isn't a great poet in the Anglo-American tradition. Uh-huh. He's a great rock musician. Now, we haven't even got the terms, I think, in which to talk about that. Because exactly, and Dylan's a good example here, if you simply take the words, you're taking very little. Mm-hmm. You've got a whole use of sound, a use of the voice, for example, which was excluded from the literary tradition. We don't have any terms to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying here is that one's got to seriously begin to think again about how we value the artistic forms we produce. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I would start from a position that I'm not in principle going to say, if you take Dallas or Dynasty, mm-hmm. I'm not in principle going to say that they aren't interesting and valuable. Certainly if you go around the world, if you go to Brazil, if you go to Hong Kong, wherever you go, you see Dallas.
They are very popular
programs. Now, you've got to... Now, either you can take two views of this. I mean, well, there are two standard views you can take. One standard view is to say, well, this just proves that people like absolute garbage, and people are absolute garbage, and we will go and read our great literary works in the academy and leave the garbage outside. The other kind of standard line is to say, well, if everybody likes them, they must be good, so we'll try and find some way of saying they're good. What I would like to do is have some way of actually differentiating. Let's take Hill Street Blues, mm-hmm. for example. Now, the early episodes of Hill Street Blues, I thought, were phenomenally interesting, phenomenally valuable.
It was it was a cinema verite sort of thing.
Well, they did two things. They made the soundtrack much more complex than it usually is.
You would hear conversations.
You didn't necessarily know
who was talking.
What conversation? Normally, the way in which a normal soap opera functions is you always know exactly what conversation you've got to follow.
This is a little like Joyce, is it not?
Yes, the polyphonic
voices that you have no way to account for
absolutely.
Necessarily.
Now, if you look at early Hill Street Blues, that's very marked, the first series. The other thing that's very marked is you didn't either know which of the narratives were important. That's to say that you got little stories that would start. Some of them would go on for 3 or 4 episodes. Some of them would go on for 5 minutes. Some of them would disappear.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think there's actually a value both in that use of soundtrack and that use of narrative, which, funnily enough, I think in certain ways has been lost from more recent Hill Street Blues. I think there's a great tendency, and this is a general feature of television.
It's moving toward the middle now.
Well, if you look at it, the soundtrack is much less complex.
Yeah.
The narratives are much more rounded off. They almost always follow a rhythm where at least one of them kind of structures the episode,
right,
which wasn't the case before. And there's a general tendency, I think, towards a kind of equalization, a flattening, at which point it seems to me the thing becomes less interesting. There's a very strong tendency on the Puritan left in Britain, and I really don't know how much it's reproduced in America, to simply want to kind of do away with the advances, the material advances of the last 30 or 40 years.
Why is this?
Well, somehow they feel that, people's souls have been lost because, they now take holidays in Spain and have cars and televisions. Now, I mean, that seems to me such a kind of ridiculous position. The liberations of the labor-saving devices in the home, the liberations of the ability to travel are fantastic.
In other words, life is earnest, life is real. It's got to hurt for it to be valuable.
Well, I mean, you've certainly got to speak to where people are.
Right.
And you are not going to take away from people the real material advances of the last 20 or 30 years by somehow wishing them back into some pre-consumer society.
Right.
I didn't even think it was heaven. I mean, the notion that it was heaven, it was absolute hell, actually. I do think that we have not yet, I mean, those of us who are critical at the same time of many of the aspects of current society, we haven't yet thought really through how to present those criticisms.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first of two discussions about film, television, literature, and popular culture. My guest is Colin McCabe, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh and a member of the production board of the British Film Institute. Colin McCabe is the author of two books about film, literature, and popular culture. Colin McCabe's most recent book, a collection of essays about film, linguistics, and literature, was published in the summer of 1985.
Colin McCabe, let me ask you to talk about the relationship between film and literature in the Academy.
Right.
Who are the defenders? Who are the attackers? What do you see within, tell me about what the curriculum in liberal arts is likely to look like over the next few years.
Well, I think this is very difficult to determine. There's really, as I understand it, there's really two dominant strains within the American Academy in regard to film. That's to say, there's a strain that a long time ago, particularly in perhaps some of the Californian universities, some of the big state colleges, decided that television and film were so important that they had to be looked at. But I can't actually give you the reason for that, but I think there was a first wave.
Yeah, the fact is that it happened.
The fact is that it happened. Right, the first wave.
What's the upshot going to be?
Well, there was a second wave as well. You see, the first wave was simply, I think, in relation to the fact that there was this huge area of culture which was not being studied. It tended to be studied in communications departments or in separate film departments. There was then a second wave, of which historically is the wave of which I'm a member, which is kind of comes from Cahiers du Cinéma, the magazine we've discussed from the 50s, which comes above all from the movements in the 60s, the countercultural movements, and the attempts to theorize those countercultural movements, particularly coming out of French theory.
All right, and what you're talking about is politicization too strong a word? The use politics toward politics.
Yes,
of these
politicization and theorization about these cultural forms mm-hmm. and the names of Roland Barthes, mm-hmm. of Christian Metz, and then you have a very different agenda set up.
All right.
I think, as I say, there was this second wave of theory, very theoretically influenced, very influenced by as I say, thinkers from France in the 60s. And that is probably the dominant strain in film and television studies in the States now. Now, there's a lot to be said in favor of that particular position, but it tends to be very heavily anti-pleasure, mm-hmm. very heavily pro-knowledge, and it seems to me very heavily to have run up a dead-end street.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're now at a crucial moment, we're talking about film and television, over the next 10 years. There's an optimistic view, which I must admit, on the kind of good mornings I share, but the good mornings aren't that often, where what one's going to see is a recasting of the humanities. It is absolutely not that I want to stop studying literature, and indeed for myself, for my own personal interest,
right.
I want to go on. I mean, that's what I want to spend more of my time doing uh-huh. than film or television.
So you have no interest in destroying. Destroying is too strong a word. You have no interest in taking apart the classics, so to speak.
Well, my view is that those who defend the classics by keeping film and television out are those who are actually destroying them,
mm-hmm.
because unless you bring them into some living relation with our cultural present,
right.
then they're a dead letter.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel that far from being the kind of destroyer of this classical tradition, I'm the one who's defending it, and the people who are saying that they're going to keep out film television are the people who are actually killing it.
Okay, now who's keeping it out of the universities, and to what ends? Is it again just a political narrow-mindedness?
It can't be simply put down to politics. It's where politics and culture come together in ways that are too simple
mm-hmm.
to simply say, for example, right or left. Very often you'll find what I consider a cultural conservative position being held by the left. I mean, the Frankfurt School, for example, are the most famous example of exactly a standard conservative dismissal of popular culture,
mm-hmm.
consciousness industry by capitalism, what we want are the virtues of the Enlightenment.
They're
Marxists.
Yeah, these are professional vested interests, maybe apart from political or ideological concerns.
It's even wider than that. It's the whole way in which those of us who kind of happen to be in the academy have formed and identified ourselves in relation to a cultural past. There's a wonderful moment in Machiavelli which sums it up. I mean, Machiavelli talks about coming back from the horrible heat and bustle of kind of Florentine politics, and he says, "I walk into my study and I pick up Livy, and suddenly everything is all right. I have mm-hmm. I have 4 or 5 hours when my whole life is perfectly at ease, perfectly wonderful." Now, that moment for me is a moment which anybody who's in the academy, anybody who's studying the humanities, has got to recognize the extent to which they're captured by that imaginary moment.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean you've got to kind of completely give it up, but you've got to start thinking about it. And I suppose that it's, when you talk about, it's the people who simply want to stay in that study with Livy.
Yeah.
alone.
Yeah.
Who are resisting it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got to fight against this. But if I could get back to how I see the next 10 years, I mean, there's
sure.
the optimistic view, which is that I think I no longer see any really specific distinction between what is done in English departments, history departments, anthropology departments. I say across the humanities.
It's a kind of a holism.
We're studying cultural form.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying there aren't very specific and very important professional practices.
Mm-hmm.
The anthropologist has their practice, the historian has their practice, the literary critic have their practices. I certainly don't want to kind of like say, but in terms of what we're studying, in terms of general methodology, in terms of what we're interested in,
mm-hmm.
these are all the same thing. Now, what I would like to see is exactly a kind of a melting away of those subject divisions,
mm-hmm.
a kind of inauguration of a cultural studies, which while absolutely preserving the best professional practices,
mm-hmm.
would start, you know, in your first year undergraduate by saying, look, what we're looking at is a whole series of cultural
sure.
artifacts.
Sure.
Now, that's the optimism, because I must be said, I don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm. Colin McCabe, our topic is film and literature and popular culture. How are the students reacting to the sorts of proposals that you're putting on the table? And let me ask you to consider also the question of standards. Aren't you sort of inviting the students to say, well, I'm going to take the easiest
yep.
route I can toward
yep.
This or that educational goal? goal.
Yeah.
And they come away with something that's an inch deep and a yeah. mile wide, yeah. and yeah. they really yeah. have no...
I think that's a very important criticism, and I think one has to take it very seriously. I mean, that's to say, first of all, students are interested. They're very interested mm-hmm. in taking what, as I say, are their major cultural experiences, and I would include rock music there with film, and sure. saying, let's look at those seriously.
Yeah.
But I couldn't agree with you more that if it becomes a mishmash, if, as it were, it's just anything goes,
yeah.
then you're really in trouble. But there, you've got a seriously planned curriculum.
All right, that's now, who's going to prevent this from happening?
Well,
is it going to be you?
Well, I don't know about me. Yeah. I would certainly, no, I'm going to sound my voice, you know.
I mean, you, the professors.
Yes. I mean, I think what you've got to say is, we're going to study across these fields, but, for example, it's why I'm very anti-separate film and television departments.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think that there is a sufficient range of historical or cultural variation to seriously study film or television by itself. That's to say, I really think that people who are studying film and television should also be looking at, say,
yeah.
the Romantic movement, or sure. say, the Renaissance mm-hmm. stage. If they're simply looking at film and television, it's too narrow. So the point is, it's actually specific building of curriculum
mm-hmm.
in which there is sufficient historical range and which a real emphasis is put on these professional skills.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where one must kill this lie about standards. I mean, that's to say, it is important, and I'm afraid to say there are people who will argue for more study of popular culture without thinking about keeping both kind of professional and theoretical rigor.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I do take that point, but it is not the case, mm-hmm. absolutely not the case, that all of us who are arguing for that take that position. I mean, I for one, am absolutely insistent on the acquisition of a series of basic skills by my students.
Mm-hmm. Colin McCabe, tell me, why should popular audiences, why should they be afraid of, what do you want to call it, ideas in media? How should they approach them? How can they sort of equip themselves to think critically about what they see in radio and TV?
I think that, you know, intellectuals have really done everybody a very bad disservice.
What, by appropriating to themselves?
By not thinking hard about how to use the medium. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't think...
By ignoring it.
By ignoring it. I don't think that it is impossible to produce interesting ideas on television for, I wouldn't say mass popular audience, but for mm-hmm. large audiences, mm-hmm. it hasn't been done yet. One would have to think very hard about how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wouldn't be, which is the form it normally is, I mean, in which the BBC tries every year or every other year. One gets invited onto a program where four people sit around as supposedly intelligent and supposedly discuss intellectual matters, and each program dies the death as nobody watches it.
Yeah.
You're going to have to think about a little bit of razzmatazz. You've got to think about an audience. You've got to think about how you're going to mm-hmm. get people to see how these ideas actually affect them.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about film, literature, and popular culture. My guest was Colin McCabe, a professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh and a member of the production board at the British Film Institute. Colin McCabe's most recent book, a collection of essays on film, linguistics, and literature, was published in the summer of 1985. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Film, Literature, and Popular Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, part two of Soundings on Popular Culture. My guest will be Robert Allen, a professor of radio, television, and motion pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen is the author of a new book entitled Speaking of Soap Operas. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the first of two discussions about the value of popular culture. Social critics from Matthew Arnold in Victorian England to Leslie Fiedler in America in the 1980s have pondered popular culture. For instance, are most movies, TV, and soap operas throwaway junk? Can they yield important insights into the nature and direction of American society? Some answers and insights from Colin McCabe, of the University of Pittsburgh and a member of the production board of the British Film Institute.
Literature, Film, and Popular Culture, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.